I have just had the opportunity to watch an amazing film that looks back more than a century to the tireless work of all kinds of women, and indeed a few men, around the issue of gaining women in the United States the right to vote. It was a long and sometimes brutally difficult crusade fought on a number of different fronts and in a number of different ways. And this amazing film, which airs on PBS on the series American Experience, chronicles especially the later years of that long, long struggle. This two-part documentary is titled The Vote. And I am very privileged indeed to speak with the writer, director, and producer of The Vote, Michelle Ferrari. You have perhaps seen her work in other documentaries that have aired before this, including Rachel Carson and The Eugenics Crusade. Again, she is largely responsible for this sprawling and illuminating documentary about the events that ultimately gained women the right to vote, which, by the way, was a right, as we are told in the film, that was not given to them, but really taken by women. I mean, that is important to acknowledge as we understand the nature of this long, difficult struggle. Michelle Ferrari, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I can't say just how impressed I was by this film. It was just incredible. Can you first of all tell us just a little bit about your own knowledge of the nature of this struggle before you undertook this project? I mean, going in, did you have any notion of just what a complex and fascinating story this was?
I did not, Greg. And I think, you know, the context for that is really important, which is to say I majored in American history in college, and I have a graduate degree in American history, and yet I knew really nothing about the women's suffrage movement. I think partly that has to do with my age. Probably when I was studying, this was a subject that was confined to women's studies programs, but I figured, given my background in history, if I didn't know anything about it, probably a lot of other people didn't know anything about it as well. And I think, you know, it typically gets reduced to a paragraph, right, that begins in 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York, with the first Women's Rights Convention, and ends in 1920 with American women being, as you said, given or granted the right to vote. And what that paragraph obscures is 72 years of sustained struggle.
There are a couple of interesting surprises in your film that I would like to kind of talk about right off the bat. And first, the first one actually, I guess, shouldn't be a surprise at all. But nevertheless, I guess I was mildly surprised that so much time is taken in the film at the outset and throughout and very much at its dramatic conclusion. So much discussion about what it means to have the right to vote. And I guess it was in my mind, maybe I thought that's one of those things that, of course, it's important. It just goes without saying it's important to have the right to vote. And yet, obviously, you thought it really is important to spell that out, because it is, in fact, of course, the longer I think about it, the more I realize it's something we really take for granted. And in particular, we tend not to fully appreciate the significance of whether or not one has the right to vote. Can we just get a word from you about why you thought that needed to be a really important theme in this film?
Well, I think because, as you said, it's something that we really take for granted. I think most Americans believe erroneously that the Constitution grants them the right to vote, and the Constitution does no such thing. In fact, the Constitution left voting rights to the states. And states were empowered to determine eligibility at the polls. So all the Constitution does, and that's the amendments to the Constitution that address voting rights, the 15th Amendment, the 19th Amendment, as well as the Voting Rights Act, all those measures do is protect people from discrimination on certain grounds. And states continue to be free to discriminate on other grounds. which is why you see effective voter suppression in many places throughout the country today. So it's absolutely not a thing we should take for granted. And I also, I suppose, am operating from a place of being dismayed by the fact that only a third of Americans vote on a regular basis. I really think that, you know, this is about the care and feeding of our democracy, and we all need to take responsibility for keeping it healthy and alive.
Right. Somebody early in the film says the right to vote is the heart of democracy. And of course, by the same token, there is something very wrong, very sickly about a democracy in which essentially half of your citizens do not have that right. And someone else at the outset says without the right to vote, essentially, a person is helpless, in a sense, left to the kindness and benevolence of strangers or the government or whatever. But I mean, with the right to vote, one can have at least some sense of agency over one's own well-being and the well-being of those you care about.
Absolutely, and the decisions that the government makes. And I think, you know, what's so revealing and inspiring about the story of the women's suffrage movement is you have three generations of women, many of whom dedicated their lives to the struggle because they had such faith in the power and promise of participatory democracy.
Another surprise in this film is that we do not end up spending all that much time with, for instance, Susan B. Anthony or Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And I think that is very much by design, because in a sense, to whatever extent any of us know the story of this long struggle, we certainly know of those two women and the significant role that they played. And my sense is that your film, in a sense, is a deliberate attempt to widen the canvas and to help us understand the important and essential work of other women to ultimately bring this to fruition, a fruition which neither of those two women, sadly, lived to see.
Absolutely. You know, there were many reasons that we chose to focus on the last decade of the movement, you know, foremost among them being the fact that at that point women were, you know, essentially out of patience. The movement becomes a mass movement for the first time in its history, and there is a lot of momentum around the issue. It's also extremely well documented relative to the 19th century, and so it gave us as filmmakers much more to work with, obviously. But as you said, you know, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton tend to be the names we know. And I felt that their story had been told. They also sort of wrote their own history of the suffrage movement you know, put themselves at the center of it and neglected the contributions of many other women. And we wanted to correct that.
Very good. And of course, there has been a fine PBS documentary primarily about those two women called Not For Ourselves Alone that people can certainly seek out if they, in fact, want to learn more about them. But again, your film is immeasurably rich because of the fact that the canvas is so wide, and it needs to be because the story of this struggle was so long and so complex. One other surprise, the fact that your film, in a sense, begins in England and not in the United States. It's a really interesting choice, and ultimately it makes perfect sense as the film unfolds. But if you would, tell our listeners why your documentary about the struggle for suffrage, of women's suffrage here in the United States, begins in England.
Well, we have a small cast of, you know, central characters, one of whom is Alice Paul. And she is, you know, in the third generation of suffragists. She's young, in her mid-20s, when she becomes involved in the suffrage movement in the United States. And she acts really as a catalyst to the movement, in my view. So she was a Quaker. She was well-educated. She went to England to continue her studies. She was studying economics in England, and she became involved with the British suffragette movement. And she really learned at the knee of these kind of radical first wave feminists who were using really aggressive tactics to try to win the vote. They were no longer, trying to convince people in parlors, in meetings and teas in parlors, that women should have the right to vote. They were standing on street corners. They were standing on soapboxes and lecturing. They were handing out pamphlets, all things that women did not do in the early 20th century. And they were, ridiculed and pilloried in the press. Suffragette was a term that was meant to diminish them. It was a twist on the term suffragist. And Alice Paul became very involved in the movement there. She was jailed a number of times. She, following the tactics of the Pankhursts, who she was working with, was jailed and declared herself a political prisoner and went on hunger strikes and was force-fed. And when she returned to the United States, she brought that playbook with her. And really infused a new kind of radical, militant strand of the suffrage movement.
Right. With tactics that were in no way, let's say, ladylike. I mean, in the opinion of, for instance, Christabel Pankhurst, who was kind of the godmother of that suffragist movement in England, the time for dainty, cautious, polite work on this issue was long past.
Well, I think that was true, particularly for younger women, though not exclusively for younger women. As the second episode of our series makes pretty clear, there was also quite a lot of room for that polite action. It was another wing of the movement.
And
disputes over strategy and tactics animated the movement throughout.
And of course, is a big part of what makes your film so rich and fascinating. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Michelle Ferrari, writer, producer, director of a two-part American Experience documentary called The Vote, which examines the last years and in particular the last decade of what had been a long struggle for women in America to gain the right to vote. As we've already said, your film does not dwell upon the earlier decades of the movement, although you do take us back briefly to that memorable meeting in Seneca Falls six decades before the events of the beginning of your film. And one of the points that is made at this point in the film that I think is really important for us to understand is the state of women, or maybe the status of women at the time of Seneca Falls, New York. One of your guests phrases it in ways that just were like a punch to the stomach, saying basically at that time a woman had no legal existence of her own, but she was, in effect, absorbed by her husband. Tell us more about the ways in which this was true. I'm sorry?
I said absorbed into the person of her husband legally.
Yeah.
Yes. This was true, obviously, for, free women, overwhelmingly white women. But yes, when married, she was absorbed into the person of her husband. She had no legal rights. If she earned money outside of the home, the paycheck went to her husband. If she divorced, the custody of the children automatically went to the husband. Doors of public universities were closed to women. There were just many ways in which they were indeed second-class citizens, if citizens at all. I mean, there are many publications in the 19th century addressing themselves to the question of whether or not women are actually people.
Hmm. And apparently, one of the schools of thought in terms of why women should not be given the right to vote is because, at least in the minds of probably most men, women were in a sense not independent beings, and thus in a sense maybe both incapable and undeserving of the right to vote. Is that a fair assessment of what was going on in a sense withholding this right that to us now seems so obvious that it should be extended to women?
I think that's definitely a factor. In the early days of the Republic, the assumption was that, you know, the approach of most states was that the vote was reserved for property-holding men, respectable white men, and anyone who was in a state of dependency was not entitled to the right to vote. So, of course, women fell into that category because they had very few opportunities to be independent. You essentially went from your father's house to your husband's house. And then, two, I think, you know, there are certainly, there's the whole theory of separate spheres and that a woman's place is in the home. And if she ventures outside of the home, then the home is in danger of collapsing.
Hmm. Early in the film, we are brought face to face with a difficult issue that will, in a sense, rear its head repeatedly through the course of this long struggle. And that is the tension between the women's suffragist movement and the movement for abolition and extending the right to vote to African Americans, including former slaves. And this has the potential and indeed the reality of driving a wedge into the suffragist movement at various points in time. Tell us more about this tension and why it was so difficult to resolve.
You know, it was, I think, one of the things that was most surprising to me when I started researching the film was the extent to which racism, and specifically the rise of Jim Crow, the kind of legacy of Reconstruction and the rise of Jim Crow, was at the heart of this struggle. And acted as a kind of enduring baffle to women's progress, which is to say, you know, in the aftermath of Reconstruction, when black men voted in huge numbers and held office, there was a backlash and a determination on the part of the former slave states to keep black men from the polls. And in order to keep black men from the polls, you certainly had to keep black women from the polls. And so there was a tremendous resistance to women's suffrage in the South because there were fears that it would reopen demands on the part of African American men to return to the polls. That acted as a real stop on the women's suffrage movement time and time again. And white suffrage leaders, in many cases, not exclusively or across the board, but in many cases, accommodated themselves to that demand on the part of the South. And that really made it next to impossible for white women and black women to work together on a national scale with regard to women's suffrage.
A really chilling moment is when your film quotes none other than the legendary Elizabeth Cady Stanton in talking about this tension between the two movements. She is horrified at the thought that the right to vote might be extended to, for instance, a former slave before it was extended to a woman like herself. And the quote is, "Think of Sambo making laws for well-educated women." I mean, to her, there was an injustice in that that she simply could not overlook. I should think, as the filmmaker, it was probably kind of painful for you and yet necessary for you to include a moment like that. I mean, it's important for us to know the stakes of this struggle and the pain that was involved in it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, every person we like to think of as a hero is flawed. Everyone is flawed. And I think it's really important to note the ways in which historical figures maybe fall short of our hopes or expectations because, you know, the racism that we're seeing, you know, addressed in the streets today goes all the way back through our history. And I think we're better equipped to cope with it if we see it clearly from the start.
We're speaking with Michelle Ferrari, writer, director, and producer of this amazing two-part documentary soon to air on PBS called The Vote. So one of the divides within the women's suffragist movement is over the basic strategy of whether or not to aim at the states or to aim for some kind of resolution of this issue or concern on the federal level. Explain the difference between those strategies and why there was this difference in strategy.
Well, right after the Civil War, when the Constitution was, you know, for lack of a better phrase, sort of opened up to address the rights of the freed people, women had this notion, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton among them, that they might slip in, you know, and achieve their voting rights at the same time. And when that door closed, when they were asked to support the 15th Amendment, which did not extend voting rights to women, there was a splintering of the movement at that moment. And Stanton and Anthony decided to pursue a federal course, decided to go after an amendment. A whole other wing of the suffrage movement decided that in fact, it was inappropriate to approach the federal government and that, you know, constitutionally, it made more sense to wage this battle at the state level because it was states that were empowered to decide voter eligibility. And there was, you know, limited success with that movement. And certainly the states in the West, for their own reasons, local reasons, extended suffrage to women far earlier than did states in the Eastern Seaboard, for example. That split continued until the Progressive Era, where there seems to be yet another opening of the Constitution, and several amendments are passed in the years covered by our series, having to do with taxation and direct election of senators and prohibition. And there was a feeling that, you know, the door was open once again, and perhaps particularly because more and more states were extending voting rights to women, which was increasing the support for a federal amendment on Capitol Hill. Representatives from suffrage states were more likely to vote for an amendment. There was a lot of momentum around the amendment in the last decade.
By the way, that was really a eye-opening moment for me in the film, was learning that Wyoming extended the right to vote to women back in, I believe, 1890, if I remember correctly, and several other Western states, including Idaho and I think Utah, Colorado, followed suit. And that just seems kind of strange that part of the country would be so open to this while the opposition to such a notion was so entrenched in other places. Is that, in a sense, kind of a mystery to this day, or are there clear reasons why certain Western states on our frontier were open to this possibility before the rest of the country was?
Well, I think there are lots of reasons. I don't think there's one overarching reason short of the fact that those states tended to have very low population. And so the more voters, the better, because basically they're trying to establish some sort of might against the entrenched Eastern establishment, right? They're trying to hold their own in the federal system. And so the more votes, the better, because that obviously increases their representation in Congress. Then, two, there were places who sought to draw women by extending the right to vote because they had largely, overwhelmingly male populations, were hurting for females. And then there were a lot of, you know, state-specific reasons. So in the case of Utah, it had to do quite a lot with polygamy. And in Idaho, it had to do with silver. And these battles that they're waging with the federal government and women's votes were regarded as an asset in those battles.
Fascinating. One of the most charismatic figures we meet in your film is one Harriet Stanton Blatch, who I believe is a daughter of Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
And the daughter. Yes.
I'm sorry? Oh, the daughter.
The only daughter.
Okay. And one of the most important new ideas that she brings to the movement is the idea of bringing more working class women into the suffragist movement. That before that, evidently, we were talking almost exclusively about rather well-educated and, shall we say, well-connected women at the forefront of this movement. Talk about this step of bringing in a sense, an entirely different kind of woman from a very different station in life into the movement, and what kind of difference that made.
Harriet Stanton Blatch is one of my favorite characters, actually, because she's sort of this bridge between the first generation and the third. And she, too, had spent time in England. She was married to a British man, and she had lived in England for a long time, and she was friends with the Pankhursts. And the idea of, you know, recruiting working-class women, women involved in the labor movement, really started in England as well, in addition to all these sort of more radical tactics. And so Harriet Stanton Blatch came back to the United States, and she had this kind of awareness about the importance of labor. And, you know, at that point, women who were working in industry were going out on strike. They were picketing. They were taking their cause into the streets. Again, not a thing that women were expected to do, something that was absolutely frowned upon at the time. And Harriet Stanton Blatch could see, first of all, that those tactics and that willingness to kind of put yourself on the line would bring new energy to a movement that was pretty paralyzed at that point. And then, two, she saw that working women had a stake, perhaps a bigger stake in winning the vote, because not only did they need to protect themselves in the same way as middle class or leisure class women might have had to, but they were in a workplace that was often exploitive. So the vote had new meaning for them, and they had a stake in having it. And so by bringing working women into the movement, really helped to create a mass movement. What had been women of the leisure classes, a very small, you know, sort of elite group of white women, became for the first time around 1909, 1910, a mass movement. The membership of the National American Woman Suffrage Association went from 9,000 to 100,000 in a decade.
Wow. It's no coincidence that as the women's suffragist movement becomes, in a sense, more popular, even more fashionable, as someone says in your film, the resistance to it becomes, in a sense, more concerted. And from both men and women, which we should make sure we mention. I want to talk first, though, about something that your film talks about and even gives us some specific examples of, and that is the way in which men sought to both ridicule and demonize the women who were involved in the suffragist movement, and in many ways, but partly through what we might think of as political cartoons and by certain films that were made that were depicting the women of this movement in a very slanted way. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of cartoons, actually, anti-suffrage cartoons, and, you know, maybe a dozen short films, all of which sort of depict women who are engaged in the battle for the right to vote as mannish, as sort of unsuccessfully experimenting with power, and as people who are abandoning their position in the home and leaving the men to do the cooking and the cleaning and the housework and the taking care of the children. And, you know, they're regarded with disdain, and if not, as you said, demonized.
You also take a few moments to remind us that not all women were in favor of this, that there were women who were part of a movement to hold this back, and no less than Mrs. Grover Cleveland, a former first lady, was among those who were in opposition to this. What would be a couple of the most significant reasons why women of this time, some women of this time, were opposed to the idea of being given the right to vote?
I would say the primary reason, I mean, there are certainly a number of women who oppose it on religious grounds. They think that, you know, it goes against the will of God. But for the most part, the women who were involved in the anti-suffrage movement, and it should be said that it was an organized movement, more so at the turn of the century than in the period we cover. By the time you get to the teens, the 19-teens, it's sort of splintering a bit, and once World War I gets underway, the anti-suffrage women are quite distracted by that and supporting allies in England and so forth. But I would say primarily it's a movement of very well-to-do women, and there's kind of a class issue at play insofar as they see themselves as not needing the vote, that they are able to influence society through their family networks. As someone in the film, one of our interviewees says, you know, they're able to knock on the door of the judge or the legislator and say, now, dear, I would like such and such, and they might be able to get it. They believed that women influenced the world, changed the world in a different way, and actually saw themselves as protecting women, that women would lose some of their prerogatives if they went down the path of equality, which, you know, is the same argument that Phyllis Schlafly made with regard to the ERA.
Right. And I appreciated how one of your speakers in the film phrases it, that it would also mean women losing themselves in the sordid world of politics. I mean, on the one hand, acknowledging that the political arena can be a very sort of dirty and corrupt world, and why in the world would a woman want to be a part of that? The idea that even going so far as to casting a vote was somehow immersing yourself in sort of the dirty, grimy, often corrupt world of politics. It's a really intriguing strategy at play there, or system of thought at play there.
Well, I think it's important to note that at the turn of the century, in the early years of the 20th century, you know, the polls were in tobacco shops. They were in saloons. Election Day was kind of a cross between a sporting event and a festival, and there was a lot of drinking. And so there's a fantastic anti-suffrage cartoon that's in part one of the series that shows a saloon, and it's populated entirely by women, and they're smoking cigars and, you know, elbows on the bar. And people were really afraid about women entering this sphere.
At this point in the film, we learn of another complicating factor, and that is that the women's suffragist movement, in a sense, runs parallel to, sometimes intersects with, the temperance movement. And this, at certain points, gives the movement maybe added strength, but at other points in time, ends up being a detriment to their efforts. Explain the connection, why there is this connection between the temperance movement and the women's suffragist movement, and how it, at certain points in time, became, in a sense, kind of a two-edged sword.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of overlap, actually. And in part, that's because the temperance movement gave women an opportunity in the 19th century to engage with the public sphere, to step out of their domestic lives and engage with the public sphere in a way that was not socially acceptable. So many, many women were engaged with the temperance movement. And when the temperance movement embraced woman suffrage, believing that the vote was a weapon for home protection, as Frances Willard, the head of the temperance movement, said, the WCTU said, there was this fusion, not an absolute overlap, but a fusion between the women's suffrage movement and the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And that became a double-edged sword because as women promised that their vote would create change in American society, in this case, you know, by limiting alcohol consumption or perhaps banning it, the liquor industry came to fear the votes of women and did everything in its power to shut the movement down. So if there were a measure coming up in a state legislature for women's suffrage, the liquor industry poured money in to defeat it.
Hmm.
And
this,
that came up again and again.
Mm-hmm. And your film tells us that votes on women's suffrage ended up going down to defeat in states like Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan, places where maybe had that issue not been on the table, perhaps these measures would have passed. But it becomes, in a sense, a heavy weight on the women's suffrage movement, particularly at certain places in the country. Tell our listeners about the dramatic moment when this effort moved so dramatically to Washington, D.C., and in particular on March 3rd, 1913, the day before the inauguration of Woodrow Wilson. This is a place in time when the work of Mrs. Paul is so important.
Miss Paul.
Miss Paul, right. Yeah, that, I meant to say Miss Paul.
Never married.
Yep.
Yes, Alice Paul and Lucy Burns, her second in command, planned the first march on Washington. And it was a parade of between 5,000 and 8,000 women who gathered in Washington, D.C. to demand a federal amendment to the Constitution guaranteeing women the right to vote. And because it was the day before Woodrow Wilson's inauguration, which was, you know, Paul understood that there would be a captive audience for this parade. But because of that, there were probably, estimates say there were 100,000 people watching this suffrage parade. And most of them were men and many of them were drunk. And the parade descended into chaos, and the spectators broke through the steel cables lining the route and attacked the women and hurled insults at them and plucked objects off of floats and sent 100 marchers to the hospital. And it made the suffrage movement kind of a cause celeb. Or at least elevated it to the front pages of the newspapers.
You tell us, actually, that because it ended with such difficulty, with at one point the parade essentially being a single line of women filing past this huge crowd of unruly men on either side, that the expectation was that the post-parade rally was going to be a rather somber affair, when in fact one of the leaders of the parade who spoke at that framed it in a very different way.
Anna Howard Shaw, the president of the American Woman Suffrage, National American Woman Suffrage Association, said, you know, if anything could prove our need of the ballot, nothing could prove it more than the treatment we receive today. And the leaders in the wake of that march were quite jubilant because they realized they had a media sensation on their hands. And in fact, Alice Paul, because the district police were under the control of Congress, she pressed for a congressional investigation, and that kept the march, the parade, and the movement in the national eye for many weeks to come.
We have not too much time left, and I want to be sure to give you time to talk about a Wisconsin-born woman who played a very important role in the last few years of this movement. And we should say that despite this dramatic event in Washington, D.C., the fight was far from over. Carrie Chapman Catt, who in a sense wanted to beat the politicians at their own game. She had her own rather sophisticated ideas about how progress could ultimately be made, and this elusive goal finally achieved.
Carrie Chapman Catt is a fantastic figure. She had been involved in the movement since the 1880s and had really been moved to become a suffragist in because of an event that took place in her house. She grew up in Charles City, Iowa, and it was Election Day in 1872, and her father and the farmhands were getting dressed to go to the polls, and her mother wasn't getting dressed. And she said, "Hey, aren't you going to get dressed? Aren't you going to vote?" And her father and the farmhands laugh, and her father says, "Don't you realize voting is too important to allow women to do this?" And she decided pretty much then, as an adolescent, that this was something that she had to work toward. So she goes on to become involved in the suffrage movement. She's one of Susan B. Anthony's girls. She comes up under Susan B. Anthony. She served as president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association for a brief time around the turn of the century, and then is drafted to come back in 1916 because the movement is really listing, and everyone knows that this is going to be the final push, and it's sort of now or never. And she comes up with what she calls the winning plan, which is a very canny, very political strategy that has to do with, the goal being the federal amendment. But the way we're going to achieve that in part is to support the state campaigns where we know we can win. And she's doing math. She's saying, okay, the more states that support women's suffrage, the more representatives there are and senators there are in Congress who are beholden to women in their home states, and the more likely we are to pass the federal amendment. And she really spends, four good years putting that winning plan in motion and cultivates a relationship with Woodrow Wilson, who remains, I think personally against women's suffrage, but at a certain point realizes that strategically it's important for him. It's expedient for him to embrace it, but he is always solidly a states' rights man when it comes to women's suffrage. So he really has no choice but to back Carrie Chapman Catt when she says, "Please, President Wilson, will you call Governor such and such and have him make a statement in support of women's suffrage?" So she has Wilson's backing, and this proves a very effective strategy. And, by the time Congress passes the 19th Amendment, before it goes out to the states for ratification, women in 26 states are voting in national elections. I mean, I think this is something we don't fully appreciate. Millions of women voted before the 19th Amendment, and millions of women couldn't vote after it.
Which is a very striking aspect of the story, for sure. And we should mention that Alice Paul is untiring in her own efforts, which are sometimes at odds with the strategy of the national office, and in particular the demonstrations which she organizes right in front of the White House. And your film tells us that this kind of thing was unprecedented, and it went on for months and ultimately led to arrests and forced feeding. I mean, it was a spectacle that really grabbed attention and raised this issue to even higher prominence.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we tend to think of, civil disobedience as something that started in the United States with the civil rights movement, but it really started with the American suffragists and Alice Paul's National Woman's Party. They organized the first protests ever, and the first to picket the White House, and did so, as you said, for months, and eventually, the district police and the Wilson administration tried to shut it down, which led to, scores of women being arrested and hunger strikes and force feeding and so forth. And really, this nothing like this had ever been done in the United States, where people were purposely getting arrested and doing it for the media. And there were a lot of disagreements about those tactics, and there was absolutely no love lost between Carrie Chapman Catt and Alice Paul. They were absolutely at odds about the best way to achieve their joint goal. I would argue, and I think the film argues, that they were both essential to the cause.
Absolutely. And I think one thing I appreciate about the way your film tells this story is that there's at least one moment when an older leader of the movement, I don't remember now who it was, just who it was exactly, but they are in a sense expressing hurt, perhaps, that some of the younger members of the movement do not seem to sufficiently appreciate the quiet, meticulous, methodical work that has been done by older members of the movement for generations. It underscores the fact that even within the women's suffrage movement, there was not always a full understanding of the role that that different factions were playing, and it was an uneasy alliance.
Absolutely, I would just say that it wasn't uniformly generational thing. I mean, there were older women involved with Alice Paul and younger women involved with Carrie Catt and the National Women's Suffrage Association. It doesn't break down cleanly along generational lines. But certainly, a person like Alice Paul had little appreciation of, say, the aftermath of Reconstruction and the terrible compromises that an earlier generation of suffragists felt that they had to make to advance their cause, in part because she'd only just been born.
Right.
So there is, there's different worldviews at play in the suffrage movement in that last decade when you have this whole new generation of activists.
Well, I must say that one of the most remarkable things your film does, and we'll leave it to our listeners to view it for themselves, is the high sense of drama that you create at the very end as those final states are voting on whether or not to ratify this amendment. And even though we are watching the film knowing full well that it all ends as we want it to end, there was such suspense in the air at the time, and there's even suspense for us as we watch the film more than a century later, in terms of how all of this will ultimately play out. And for achieving that, I tip my hat to you. It's a marvelous film, start to finish, again, called The Vote, soon to air on PBS on stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. The writer, director, producer, Michelle Ferrari. Michelle Ferrari, congratulations on what I can only call a masterpiece. This is such an important story, and you tell it so well. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It was a pleasure speaking with you.